Do I have any nominations? I recognize Mr. Mbuyani. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, and sorry for coming late. My name is Honorable Mbuyane. I hereby nominating Honorable Zuki Faku for the position of the chairperson, acting chairperson.
That's right. Thank you, Mr. Mbuyane.
Yeah, and also, man, given the opportunity, I'll also raise an apology because I'm attending another meeting. So that, yeah, thanks, Chair. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Mbuyane. Mayor Faku, do you accept the nomination?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, ma'am. Are there any other nominations?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
In that case, Mayor Faku, you are the acting chairperson. Thank you, ma'am.
I think you're right. Yes, sir. No, that looks like a...
Good morning, Honorable Members, our DG, Mr. Thabani Zulu, the Secretary of the Committee, Mr. Kutsi, members of the Department of Energy, the officials of the department, NGOs present here, the media, the staff, ladies and gentlemen, I greet you this morning. Let us note the apology of the of our chairperson, Honorable Majola, and I welcome you all in the meeting. You are welcome. I declare the meeting open. We are correcting the most of the majority of the members are here. So the meeting, we declare the meeting open. I'm going to request the secretary to tell us the apologies of this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. As you've indicated, Mr. Majola, the chairperson, who's on study leave, and then also Mayor Kada, who indicating that he's running late, but she will be joining us, and then Mr. Esther Raisin requesting to leave at 12 o'clock, Chair, as he needs to attend the PC on trade and industry, and then Mr. Mbuyani, who requested now to leave immediately to attend the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. And then also an apology from the Minister, Mr. Khadebe, who's attending a cabinet meetings, chairperson. So those are the apologies.
Sorry. There's also an apology from my side. The Deputy Minister communicated to me this morning. She's also attending her apology. She is not well. Deputy Minister, Ambassador Thembi Majola. Yes, yes. Thank you. Okay, thank you. We're noting the apologies, Honorable Members. We're now proceeding to the presentation by the IPP office. Over to you, Mr. Maduna or Karim. Or DG, over to you, DG. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee, and thanks for inviting the Department and the IPP Office to present an update on our IPP program. As you are aware that you are not presenting certain aspects of the IPP program for the first time to this committee, so we hope that the presentation by our IPP office led by Karen and Maduna will not be a long one. Whilst we have presented to you a very long document, most of the issues as well that are highlighted on the content of our presentations are issues that the majority of the members of our committee are familiar with, and will then do the highlights on the key areas, particularly on the process that you are currently busy with to conclude certain strategic aspects of our IPP work. So we have agreed that Mr. Maduna, supported by our leader in the office, Karen Breitenbach, will take us through the presentation and then we'll entertain the questions thereafter. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and members.
Thank you so much, DJ. Over to you, IPP office.
Thank you much, very much, Chair. Thank you, DG. Thanks, Karin. I would go through the presentation quickly. My name is Maduna Ngobeni from the IPP office. I've been tasked today to do the presentation on behalf of the office. If there's more questions, I would look into Karin to answer them. trying to work out the Thank you very much. Good morning, members, and also the public at large. I'm sure most of you are aware of the IPP program, so I'm not going to explain it in more details, the program itself, but focus more on what we have done and the status up to date. But the presentation itself is very inclusive. It covers a number of issues, including policy issues and how those issues come in together in case we are not familiar with certain aspects of the program. This is just the overview of the program. I'm going to go in each and every point today at a bit high level. This slide, it explains the interlink between the different policies that are in place and also the different legislations that help us or that guide us in the implementation of the program. You can see there right on top that we talk to the global issues, global and regional issues that affect the program directly, but with a broader impact to the country as a whole. You'll see we refer to COP21 and the commitment made under COP21 in terms of reducing greenhouse emissions. And we also look at the economy, we look at the political issues that got an influence into the implementation of the policies themselves. If you look at number two, it then talks to bring it a bit home, looking at the national policies that are in place. In particular, reference there is the National Development Plan, which makes certain undertakings with regards to the energy mix of the country and the different technologies that need to be considered. And then following after that, we got the National Infrastructure Plan and then also the Integrated Energy Plan, which is driven by the Department of Energy itself. And then lastly, from a planning point of view, then we talk about the Integrated Resource Plan. However, before one look at the Integrated Resource Plan, you need to look at the legislations that guide the Integrated Resource Plan. We got what we call the National Energy Act that established the regulators, in the regulator somewhere here. And then you got also the Electricity Regulation Act itself, which empowers the department to develop the IRP and also spells out the steps that need to be followed in development of the IRP itself. And then lastly, it's the IRP document itself that gets developed by the department with the different energy carriers that needs to be implemented. The minister then makes a determination from that IRP on your last, which is number three. And the determinations, that's the one that guides the department with regards to the procurement program, and eventually the procurement program is done by the IPP office in terms of how it should be implemented and the procurement itself, but the program itself, it remains the custodian of the Department of Energy. We are the implementing agent in accordance with the determinations that were made by the minister, which is aligned to the IRP and also aligned to the Electricity Regulation Act, as I've mentioned. Just to look at, I think some of these I've already explained on my previous slide. It just gives you more context into what I was saying. The commitments that the country has made, the fact that we need to be more and more efficient in the manner in which we do things, looking at different technologies that are in place as outlined in the IRP, and the key point there is the cost that needs to come down, and also we need to drive efficiencies as we do that. But on the first bullet, we do acknowledge the fact that at the moment the economy is not growing as fast as expected, and that will have an impact on the programs that we are running, from building of new generation capacity and also supported by the guidance from the IRP itself. We also acknowledge the fact that as the prices of technologies changes, that would also change the thinking in terms of the different technologies that needs to be implemented. But having said that, one of the key aspects that I think the IRP tries to address as well is the water availability. As you know, that we are a water scarce country, actually, in South Africa, we don't have a lot of water. So as we develop programs, as we put more megawatts into the system, we need to make sure that we are sensitive to the availability of water. And also we need to look at the socio-economic development elements of the program, because developing the programs alone without considering the societies around where the projects are located is very important. Now, when we talk about socio-economic development in terms of the program in particular, we look at unemployment, we look at training, we look at enterprise development, we look at number of issues to make sure that the project, each and every project, it makes a difference in the areas or in the communities where these projects are located. I can talk to that a little bit more later on in the process. Lastly, I think the last bullet just talks about the fact that whatever we do in the energy space, whatever we do in the IPP space in particular, we need to consider the fiscal implications associated with that. The more you put that on the balance, government balance sheet, it's going to have an impact on the country as a whole. So we need to be more efficient in the manner which we handle it, and also in the manner which we commit government in these projects. All the projects that we have done to date, we made sure that there's a light touch on the government balance sheet. It doesn't have a severe impact. It becomes a contingent liability rather than being an actual liability on government. Looking at the legislations in more details, policies, I'm not going to go into all of them, but the important part is to acknowledge or to note the fact that in 1998, the government or the Department of Energy approved an energy white paper which talks to what needs to happen in the sector. There are a number of things that are outlined by the energy white paper, one of which is reform of the electricity market. I'm going to try and focus on the electricity market because that's what today is all about. And looking at the energy white paper itself, you realize that certain things has happened and certain things didn't happen since then. But what has happened to date is that the implementation of IPP, it did happen, and we managed to achieve what we anticipated to achieve under that white paper. Obviously, the white paper is a long-term planning document, but supported by other legislations and other policies, I would confidently say we managed to deliver on that particular aspect. However, when you talk about competition, we believe there's still room to improve the competition as anticipated by the white paper. Probably hasn't happened the way we thought it going to be. Open access as well, it's one of the key issues that I think going forward, we believe as an office, these issues need to be addressed. Open access, I'm referring to the transmission lines. At the moment, we know that there's only one player that's dominant in the transmission space, and we need to make sure that the playing field is a bit level there to make sure that everybody can have access to the transmission line without being discriminated in a way. But if you look at the Electricity Regulation Act, which was promulgated in 2006, it does talk to these issues. In particular, it refers to open access. If you look at the second bullet, the sub-bullet and second bullet. Sub-bullet 2, it does refer to non-discriminatory access to the transmission and the distribution power system. This is in the Act itself. It does acknowledge that that should happen, On whether it happens the way it's supposed to be in real time, I think that's a question mark. And I suppose we still need to do more work to make sure that that happens in a manner in which the Act anticipates it should happen. And if I move back to the sub-bullet 2, if you look at the ministerial determination, the Act it also acknowledged that the minister needs to make the determinations in terms of who must build the new generation capacity and who should buy that new generation capacity. And I think that process of making determinations, it has worked well in terms of the minister doing those determinations. However, sometimes when it comes to implementation, that's where challenges sometimes becomes apparent. But I will talk to that maybe a bit later. Looking at the last bullet, what we're trying to do there is to try and link everything. You link the NDP, as I've mentioned on my initial slide, you link the IEP, you link the IRP, and then you say all of those policy documents together, they help you to implement, or they help us to implement the IPP program. This slide, it just gives you a high-level overview of the integrated energy plan and the different sectors that are covered by the energy plan itself. You will notice that there is an integrated electricity resource plan, which is the electricity sector that we are referring to today. But you also got the gas utilization master plan, and you also got the liquid fuel master plan, which I'm not going to focus on those two, but I think the point that we're trying to make is that there are a number of plans and master plans that are in place which intends to guide the energy sector in totality, because it's important that we look at the energy sector, not just the electricity portion of the energy sector, but we look at across board and see where do we fit in and see whether we're still aligned to the objective of the country as we do our portion of the work. Our portion of the work, it relates to the integrated electricity resource plan, and that's what we implement as an office. Obviously, we did a lot of work on the other sectors as well, like in the gas side, but with a view to implement the electricity side and also assist in the establishment of the gas market itself. You will see the underneath, it's the current structure of the sector on your left-hand side, on my left-hand side of the picture. It's the current structure of the electricity sector as it stands. You will realize that Eskom appears across the distribution or across the value chain, from generation, transmission, distribution, and also to the supply of the actual customers. However, when it comes to distribution, you do have municipalities there playing a role. It might not be a big role, but they do play a role. They cover most of the residential customers and some of the commercial and industrial customers, but majority of the industrial customers are covered by Eskom. In terms of sales, Eskom sells about 60% of the energy to the distribution sector. And if you look at on the generation side, you also get some municipalities doing their own generation, but by and large, those generators are old. Not all of them, they are working, not all of them, they're in good order. So we do say municipalities, they also generate, but in reality, probably there are very few megawatts that get generated at the municipal level. If you look at in the right-hand side, it just explains the IPP office itself and the work that we do and the areas that we cover. At a very high level, explain that we cover non-renewables, which is your coal program. We will talk about it in a few minutes. We also cover renewables. We also provide advisory services to the department and also to the region, to certain countries in the region that ask for that particular assistance. This might sound like a repetition, but it's just trying to make the point that how we are established as an office and how the different legislations and policies comes in together to give effect to what we are doing. You will see that I've explained the IEP and the IRP, they are number one, and then number two followed by the ministerial determination, and then number three it's the determinations, the concurrent by the regulator. In terms of the Act, the minister will make the determinations, but the regulator need to concur to that determination before it can be promulgated in the Government Gazette. Now, the IPP office gets its mandate from the department in terms of what needs to happen, in terms of the program that we need to do, one of which is the determinations, but there's also other interventions that the department may, you know, give guidance to the IPP office or may require the IPP office to implement. The IPP office is established through a memorandum of understanding between National Treasury, the Development Bank of Southern Africa, and the Department of Energy. So the IPP office is not an entity by itself, but it's established through those, through that memorandum of understanding, and there's some agreement in terms of what the IPP office should do under that particular agreement, or should I say what the three parties should do under that particular agreement. The DBSA got a role to play, which is an administrative role in terms of the establishment of the IPP office, the employees of the IPP office, and National Treasury sits with the bank account for the IPP office, which is GTEC in particular, because we are not an entity, so we can't have a bank account for ourselves. All the money that we raise through the programs, it goes into that Treasury bank account and then pay DBSA accordingly for the services rendered. If you just to step back, the IPP office, we operate using the money that we got from development fees when we close projects. So there's no other revenue that comes to the office except that. And that helps us to procure, to draft the procurement documents, and also to monitor the projects that are already in implementation. I'll give you a sense of the project that we are monitoring just in a second. This just to explain the mandate in more details, and I think I've covered already. Now, I also mentioned the fact that in addition to the determination, we also get other written instructions in terms of what we need to do. One of the things that we do contract management. We manage the contracts for the next 20 years, the ones that have been signed with the IPPs, and make sure that the IPPs comply with the obligations as stipulated in those agreements. One of the things that we expect the IPPs to do is to create jobs, and they commit to a number of jobs that they're going to create over the duration of the contract, and we monitor them on those jobs on a quarterly basis. They give reports back to us in terms of how many jobs they've created, and they also expected to do enterprise development. That's money that I'm going to talk to a bit later. The enterprise development in terms of the areas where the projects are located, they make commitment how much money they're going to spend on the enterprise development, how much money they're going to spend on the socio-economic development, how much money they're going to spend on other items as per the contract, and we monitor them over the period of 20 years. That's form part of the contract management. We also look at cross-border projects, the INGA project, which is the popular one. We also assist other countries in the region in terms of implementing their own IPP program. We spoke about the sector planning, the sector support planning. As I've mentioned, the IRP, we also provide support in the development of that. We also look at the gas utilization master plan. We provided support in the development of that process, that plan. But more importantly, we look at this. That bullet, I think it's bullet number. Bullet number five. It talks about the gas sector and the gas to power program that we are initiated as the IPP office, and the work that we have done under the instruction of the Department of Energy. I will talk to that program in more detail a bit later. But most importantly, as we implement the programs, we're also required to look at the alternative funding models for black participation in the programs. We do realize that at the moment, we struggle with funding of the equity when it relates to participation by blacks. And we are looking at other mechanisms on which how we could improve that. Hopefully we would have a report soon that explains that in more detail. Lastly, we also looked at how best can we implement IPPs across the value chain, not just to focus on Eskom being the buyer, but looking at other possible off-takers. And we also believe that we need to, as we look at other off-takers, it could be municipalities, and municipalities' balance sheet may have to be enhanced to make sure that they are in a process or they are capable of buying the power from the IPPs. This slide, it gives a high-level overview of, firstly, the IRP itself, the Integrated Resource Plan, and what the plan requires us to build over the duration of 20 years. You will see that according to the plan, it says 17,800 megawatts needs to be built from renewable energy. And it also targets the other technologies as well. But if you look at from the commitment as per the plan and what the minister has determined to date, but not just to look at the renewables, but everything in total, you will realize that we're sitting at around 30 gig that needs to be built. However, we should mention that, having said that, most of the determinations that are currently in place will have to wait for the new IRP to guide in terms of the required new generation going forward. So not everything is in the procurement phase yet, and there are certain portion of the determination, which I will explain a bit later, that it's in the procurement phase. But the rest of the other determinations at the moment, they are on hold. Now, looking at the determinations in more details and also outline when were these determinations made, if you look at the first one, which is number one, it was made in 2011 with 3,725 megawatts. This was the first determination that was made by the minister and to implement the program way back in 2011. Then if I were to just list all of them, you will see that the second one was made in 2012 with 3,200 megawatts, the third one in 2015 with 6,300 megawatts, the last one in 2016 with 1,500 megawatts, which was for the solar park. Now, in terms of actual implementation, if we go back to the first one, We procured to date 6,376 megawatts from IPPs. This is over six windows, which means we procured over six phases. Maybe I should use that way. Some days back, we asked why we call it windows, not doors or something. But anyway, it's just a term that was used to try and describe the process rather than it having any particular meaning that is different from a window. Now, out of the sixth round, we procured 112 projects. I should mention that out of the 112 projects, the total number of megawatts, it's 3,774 megawatts that have reached a financial close to this called commercial operation, which means they are already in operation. And that amounts to 62 projects. Now, most of the projects, I'm sure you are aware, these projects, they're not big projects. Most of them, the big ones, they range between 1 and 75 megawatts, which is the PV. And then the wind one, the maximum it could be is 140 megawatts. And then the other one, biomass, is much smaller, so like 19 megawatts per project. And then what we define as small project is the project that falls between 1 and 5 megawatts. In total, those 1 and 5 megawatts, there are 20 that we have procured to date. And there's a context to the 1 and 5 megawatts range. The forecast was to give an opportunity to local players so that they can do the project by themselves, supported by the bigger players. However, I mean, we haven't finalized or we haven't signed any project between the 1 and 5 megawatts. I think I'll talk to the signing a bit later, but the project that currently needs to be signed is your wind of 4, 3.5, and the 1 and 5 megawatts, which is the small project that we are referring to. Now, I've mentioned that we have 6 windows, and the number of projects that have been signed to date is 64. The ones that are operational is 62, which means we've got 2 that still needs to reach a operational phase. However, if you look at, just that I don't have numbers, let me see if I can, if you look at that column there, we got 48 projects. This project has been announced, but they are not signed yet. The total megawatts that we are looking at is 2,421 megawatts. Out of those 27 projects that are not signed, and out of the 27 projects, it amounts to 2,421 megawatts that needs to be signed. Yeah. So, but if you include the project that we haven't announced, which is 19, then it leads to 48 projects in total. The 19, I'm sure you would remember that we had what we call expedited window when we had the load shedding and the challenges with our electricity supply, and we needed to find megawatts into the system as quickly as possible. We came up with this concept of expedited window, and then that's where the expedited term comes from, and we procured 19 projects under that, but those were never announced. Now, if you look at the other determinations, like, for instance, the solar park, the 6,300-megawatt determination, those ones are probably safe to say we haven't done anything on those, and we're waiting for the new RP to give guidance. Now, moving from renewables into coal, there's a determination for 2,500 megawatts, which the minister made in 2012, and out of the 2,500 megawatts, we procured 2 projects in October 2016, and the total amount of the project cost is about 40.4 billion rand, which is what, if these projects reach financial close, this is what will be invested in these projects and be spent on local procurement and also purchasing of certain products, which would assist in the construction of the project. This project referred to it Tabametsi, which is in the Limpopo Lephalale area, and then the other one is Kanyisa, which is in the Mpumalanga area. You could see that the bigger one is the one in Limpopo with 557.3 megawatt, and the smaller one is the Mpumalanga one, which about 306 megawatts. And the Mpumalanga project, it uses discard coal. I think it's important to make the point. It doesn't use thermal coal. So you've got 2 types of coal, not to probably more than that, but in this context, there's 2 types of coals being used. Thermal one, which means you've got a mine that feeds the power plant. The coal comes straight from the mine to the power plant. And then the second one, discard coal, it's the coal that is lying out there, not being used, meaning that it's low-quality coal. So the Mpumalanga one, it takes the coal that is already there, has been mined already. Discard coal is not used for anything, and then you use it to generate electricity. So in a way, it cleans the environment because you are taking the coal that is lying there. You don't know what to do with it. You then use it to generate electricity. So that's the Mpumalanga project. Now, looking at the 2 projects that I've referred to, there's PIC that provides funding to it. There's also IDC. There's also DBSA providing funding, especially to the black participant. And that amounts to a tune of about 3.2 billion rand of equity that comes from those 3 institutions. And then the local banks, probably all of them, they also contribute in getting to that 40 billion rand that is required. We also made an estimation in terms of the number of jobs that we will get out of the project. We think we're going to get about 6,600 jobs will be created with 13,500 jobs during operation over the 30-year period. This is a 30-year project. It's different from the renewables. Renewables is a 20-year contract. This is a 30-year contract, which is much longer. But what is important about this contract is that the price is fixed over the 30-year period. It only escalates by CPI, and in that CPI, we also made flexibility in terms of fuel, which is diesel cost, because diesel costs will go up and down, therefore we should allow for that, and also labor cost, we should also allow for that. But when we did our own analysis and we tracked those two or more elements, we realized that it would amount to about CPI plus one over the duration of the contract, that increase. I think it's important to mention that because in most cases, the cost of power generation is not known. We always review it on quarterly basis, like according to the MYPD on a three-year basis. Yet in this case, you got a much fixed cost, and you can predict the price over a longer period of time. It also gives certainty to the industry, to your manufacturing, to whoever that wants to come into the country and invest, that this is what the price of electricity is going to be, rather than continually reviewing the price from time to time. I've mentioned the cross-border project. There was a determination for 3,750 megawatts for cross-border. We haven't done much here because of the fact that we need to re-look at the IRP and then see whether we still need to build so much megawatts going forward. So the cross-border program is there. We do have the determination to do it, but we haven't done much on that. So, but as we do cross-border, there are a number of things that we need to look at. We need to look at the transmission lines as well. How do we integrate ourselves with the region? We need to look at which countries would need more power. But obviously, most of the cross-border project, they are looking at South Africa as an off-taker. But that does not mean South Africa can then cannot off-sell the power to other countries. So we can still off-sell that power or sell it to our neighboring countries and make sure that they also got enough generation capacity. The gas program, we had a determination for 3,126 megawatts and that needs to be built. And then a second one, which is about 600 megawatts, which we regarded as a strategic partner for SEF and PetroSA. Now, the gas program is much broader than what we mentioned here. Here we refer to two ports that we need to focus on, which is the Richards Bay port and then also the Kuha port. But when you look at those two ports and you combine the cost of building these power plants, it's approximately 47 billion rand that will be invested by merely initiating these two projects in Kuha and also Richards Bay. But our take on it is that this is not just a gas-to-power project, but it's much broader than that. It's a development of a gas industry in South Africa. Because if we develop a gas industry, it starts unlocking the benefit associated with gas, and you can also start allowing people to do investment in the upstream because they know that there's a market already internally that can uptake the gas. And we also look at what is it that we can do. I mean, obviously, this one, it looks at LNG, which is liquefied natural gas, meaning you're bringing the gas using a ship into the port, and then from the port, then you use pipelines, you use trucks to truck the gas wherever it needs to be. But there's also another option of looking at, in the long term, of looking at the pipeline, for instance, from Mozambique to South Africa. That's another option. And if you do the pipelines, it would cut across a number of cities in the Mpumalanga area and all the way to Witbank, where it could start supporting those economies where currently dominated by coal. And we all know that coal will not last forever. At some point, we'll run out of coal. When that happens, we need to be ready as a country to try and make sure that those towns where currently supported by the coal industry do not collapse. And we did some work around that, and we'll look at the different options on how we could deal with it. We do have some understanding on how the gas industry could work in that particular space. And what is important for us is that we did a gas utilization master plan, which looks at all these different elements and how it comes in together. And we believe that by looking at that, incorporated into the IEP, it could make a difference in terms of guiding the country going forward on how investment should be made and on which resource that investment should be made. And we believe gas is a game changer, and actually this is a term that comes from the IDP, the National Development Plan, in terms of how we should utilize gas as a country and how we should make sure that gas become part of our economy. Because at the moment, as a country, we are not energy efficient. We use electricity for almost everything. Research has shown that you don't have to use electricity for everything. In fact, if you want to do space heating, you better use gas for space heating. And secondly, if you want to do cooking, you better use gas for cooking rather than using electricity for that. You're becoming more efficient by doing that. But at the moment, because the resources, not all the resources are available, and then the public or the communities are constrained in terms of what they could utilize as an energy source. As a result, they utilize electricity for almost everything. And then when we get into trouble from a consumption point of view, we then say people shouldn't use electricity, for instance, for space heating. They shouldn't use it for water heating, and then we start pushing it to the other sources. But the problem is that by the time when you do that, the other sources are not readily available to cover that space. So we need to make sure that we bring in the different sources, and we make it a point that people, they've got a choice in terms of what they could use. They use the right resource for the right need. We also had another program which we call co-generation. This program by and large focused on biomass, and mostly it's located in the KZN area and Mpumalanga. That's where most of the biomass are. And this program didn't advance that much. We did procure one project, and we're of the view that it could grow and become much bigger. However, we think it needs to be relooked because of the cost implications associated with this particular project. It's proven to be slightly more costly as compared to the others. However, we believe if this program were to be implemented, it will definitely make a difference to those areas which are currently dominated by biomass projects, and they don't have wind or PV project in those particular areas. However, the Mpumalanga area, they do have an extra coal project, and also Limpopo, they do also have a coal project. But in the KZN area, there's a need to look at other projects that could also give the similar benefits. If we look at in terms of what approvals we got to date, but focusing in particular now to between the 3.5 and 4, these are the projects that still need to be signed. These are the projects that probably they've been in the media for a very long time. But we looked at those projects, and we look at all the other projects as well across the board in terms of what is in place, what is not in place, and I'm pleased to indicate that most of the approvals are in place when it comes to the different program. However, you do have certain approvals outstanding when it comes to other projects that we still need to implement. But when it comes to the 3.5 and 4, as I've mentioned, that was the most contagious window. We believe that everything is in place now to get those projects signed. The other projects, you realize if you look at the gas, there's still a lot of things that needs to be done under the gas program, but you should take that in context because we mentioned the fact that there's an IRP that needs to be looked at as well. However, I mean, we believe that if we look at the gas, we start looking at the gas as early as now, it will take about almost 5 years to get the program off the ground. So it's important to plan, it's important to prepare. One of the critical things when it comes to gas is that we need to do the necessary training. Actually, this is not just for gas. Any new program, before you implement it, you need to prepare and you need to be ready for it. One of the things that we have realized is that when we implement a program, we expect the program to also do the training. And probably it's not a most efficient way of doing things. It's better to start with the training before you implement the program, so that by the time when you implement the program, you've got people who are already trained to do the implementation, and not to expect the program to train and also implement, because otherwise you got a mismatch. By the time you finish training, by the time the project finished training these people, the construction is also finished. So the people haven't benefited much. But if you train them in advance in preparation for the program, by the time they finish training, the program also kickstarts, and then you start utilizing the people that you have trained, and it's all aligned. And we believe, we think there is a solution to that. We can utilize some of the money that comes from the existing project, which I'm going to talk about just now, in training and in preparation for the program that's still to come. We just did a high-level overview in terms of the interventions from the department. One of the things that we thought we need to highlight is the fact that I mentioned the fact that the IPP office is not an institution by itself. It's not established through a legislation, but through a memorandum of understanding between the three parties, and that agreement will expire in March 2019. Which means we need to engage with the department in terms of that, in terms of whether it's extended or we put something else, or I don't know. But the point we're making is that there is that agreement that needs to be relooked at. And then in terms of monitoring, I've mentioned the contract management that we do. Reporting, we report to the department on a quarterly basis in terms of what we have achieved and what we have seen from the project. Those reports are available on our website. Anybody can view them, can have a look at what we have achieved to date. And we also working closely with SEF. SEF was given the mandate to do solar water heater program, the repair and replace. We implement that on their behalf. We also provide support to the department in terms of the IRP, in terms of the IEP. We also provided support in the development of the gas utilization master plan in particular. And we did a lot of investigation in terms of how can you utilize gas. I think that's the point that I was making earlier on. And how can we then integrate the gas program with the regional countries, and so that it's not just a South African program, but we share the benefit of gas with our neighboring countries. But this applies in particular to the gas pipeline from Mozambique if we were to initiate that. We also did a lot of work on storage and off-grid solutions, because we do believe that if you bring in more and more renewables, you need to solve the storage challenge, and we think the price of storage is coming down from time to time. It will be easier to incorporate storage and further reduce the cost of electricity to the consumer, in particular the indigenous household. We do believe that as we continue with coal, we need to look at much cleaner options of implementing coal, because if we don't look at cleaner options, coals will become more and more difficult to develop, and we believe that there are new technologies that will make sure that coal is cleaner and it doesn't have an impact on the communities where those projects are located. Funding mechanism, we do believe that the IPP office, at the moment, is funded through development fees that are collected from the projects. However, as we go forward, we do believe that we need to look at that structure and look at the sustainability of such approach, especially when it comes to the monitoring of the project over the 20-year period. But equally so, we do believe that we can look at other alternative ways of not just the funding of the IPP office, but also to look at the impact of the program on the government's balance sheet and how do we mitigate that challenge. The first bullet there just refers to the support that KfW have provided in terms of what investment we could do and also what work we can do with regards to renewables. They've given us agreed to give about 4 million euros to support renewables energy. I think some of these it would be repeating, but I think if I were to focus on this particular slide, I would say most of the issues that we are faced with, they relate to signing of the project, and also they relate to the IRP, and also they relate to what impact will that have on the country as a whole. If you look at the bullet, the first bullet, we reflect the fact that we do have an issue about the constraint in supply, electricity supply. And when we started the program, the main issue was to alleviate that constraint, because there wasn't sufficient generation capacity in the country. But as we do that, we felt it's important that we also create fiscal space, meaning that we shouldn't cloud the government balance sheet as we deal with the constraint in generation capacity. But we did it in such a way that it doesn't have an impact on the ESCOM balance sheet, so meaning that ESCOM shouldn't be impacted with what we do for the IPPs. And I've made the point about the light touch on government balance sheet as we implement the program, because it's important so that government can be in a position to implement on other social economic problems rather than focusing all its, putting all its money on building of new generation capacity. And most importantly, the program had element of social economic transformation in it, whereby we require black participation, we require community participation, we also require that the communities where the projects are located should get direct money from the project for social economic development support. And because the communities, they also take equity in the project, they also get dividends in return, but they have to borrow money to fund the equity, and I think we believe we need to look at even a more efficient ways in which communities they borrow money so that they can realize their dividends earlier in the process rather than waiting a bit longer to get those dividends. Enterprise development is important, and the way we are looking at it now, I refer to the Solar Water Heater Program, and as we train people for the Solar Water Heater Program, the IPPs, they work with us, they help us to train young professionals so that they work for on the solar water heater program, but they can also work on the IPP's place in terms of PV, installing of PV, or any work that relates to the IPP space. So it's a complementary kind of approach as we deal with training and money that is collected under the IPP program, but not just train for IPPs, but also training for other programs that are related to the electricity sector. Now, I think I've covered this. This is more or less similar to what I've mentioned earlier on in the beginning of the presentation, but this one, it explains it in more details in terms of what the different plans target to build over a particular time. If, for instance, you look at the NDP, the IRP, I've spoken about the IRP, If you look at the NDP, it got a target of about 19% from baseline of 1% to be generated, to have a reserve margin of about 19% from a baseline of 1%, which that was, and that was expected to be in 2019. But this just gives a sense of the commitment from the different plans and how do you pull them all together. And you can see that the, also the target for renewables, which is about 10,000 megawatts from baseline of 44,000 megawatts, which should come from renewables. And there's a lot of targets that are outlined under the different plans, but just to give context to the IP program, how it fits into the whole government policy framework. Karish is referring to the strategic goals of the DOE. I think if you look at the first goal there, it's security of supply, and it's important that as the DOE, because they've got the mandate to do to ensure security of supply to the country, and that's the first part that is actually entrenched in the Electricity Regulation Act itself. And then secondly, the infrastructure. DOE is expected to facilitate an efficient, competitive and responsive energy infrastructure, meaning that we need to, as we build the generation supply, we need also to build the infrastructure. This could relate to transmission and distribution to make sure that the service is rendered accordingly. And the third goal is to regulate the sector and also allow for competition to ensure that there is an improved energy regulation and competition on the sector. And universal access, I think that it's a very popular norm about universal access, which relates to electrification in particular. But you can only do electrification if you got access generation capacity. You know, you need to have enough generation capacity so that you can electrify more households, so that you can have make sure that more people have got access to not just to electricity but to energy as a whole. And the fifth one is environmental asset or environmental impact. As we build new infrastructure, we need to be aligned to the needs of the communities, and also we need to make sure that from environmental point of view, we're not found wanting. We're doing it in a way that is sustainable. Okay, and then we also report, or we also align ourselves to SIP 1, SIP 8, and SIP 9. And we mentioned the different program that aligns to that in particular. Looking at pricing, I think it's a known fact that when we started the program, it was very expensive. The first round was high, but you can see how the price dropped from the first round to the last round that we need to sign. If you look at this slide, the middle column, you will see the price coming down to where it is now. And then if you look at on the left-hand side, these are the megawatts that has been built, the operational megawatts, and it also show you how they came online from the first day when we started the first project, which was in 2013-14, when the first project got connected to the grid, and then from there, the project continued to connect into the grid. I should explain that the reason why it's staggered in this way, it's because each project got different connection dates, and the connection dates are aligned to the ESCOM requirement. So ESCOM would give instruction that this project will be connected by a particular date, and then that project will have to work towards that particular date that has been outlined in the connection agreement. And then if the project doesn't connect as per the date outlined in the contract, it gets penalized for not connecting on time. And I think the last one on the right-hand side, the point we are making is that renewables is clean, generates clean energy, and as we do that, we save a lot of emissions, and we also save a lot of water. As South Africa is a water-scarce country, you can see that the amount of water that we have saved to date and the amount of emissions that we have reduced to date it's also outlined there. I can mention the emissions, about 22.5 million tons of carbon emissions that have been saved, and then from water point of view, it's 26.6 million kiloliters of water that, the kiloliters of water, that's relative to the amount of water that could be used in the fossil fuel power generation plant. This is what we have saved from a renewable point of view. Looking at investment and money and jobs created to date, if you look at, start from the left-hand side, the amount of money that is committed by the project, including the one that has been invested already, is about 201.8 billion rand to date. That's from bid window 1 to 4 and also including the smalls. The table there indicates the bar graph. It indicates the amount of money per window and then accumulative to the last window, which is the small bid window 2 S2, which is the bid window 2 second phase 2. And then from there, you will realize how it breaks it down from between debt and equity. I don't have a pointer, but you could see that the dark brown one is your debt, and then your equity is the light one, the light blue. That's where mainly the problem is from a funding point of view, because you need to raise that equity for one to participate. When we talk about black participation, that's where IDC, PIC, they normally assist in terms of raising the equity for black participation, but we believe we need to come up with a much better way of doing that because I think black people, they still struggle to raise equity. In terms of jobs, you could see how we escalated the jobs since from the beginning of the program in 2012-13 to date, and the number of jobs that have been created to date. You'll see that we've created about 34,000, 35,000 if you round it off, jobs that have been created. And these jobs, they are across the different countries, across the different provinces, mainly in rural areas. That's where the projects are located. We also look at, in terms of socio-economic benefits, and we also look at in terms of jobs for South Africans. Most of the jobs that we refer to here, in fact, it relates to jobs that we have created for South Africans, and also in particular in those communities where the projects are located. We also look at, we believe that if we add the extra 27 projects, it will make a significant impact in those communities where the projects are located. Just to look at the socio-economic development socio-economic development, enterprise development for the projects that are in operations already, because your socio-economic development, you only receive the revenue once the projects are implemented and they're in operation. So you will realize that we committed certain amount of money, and then in reality how much money has been used. If you look at up to December 2017, that's about 504 million rand that has been spent on socio-economic development. Maybe I should explain this a bit later. There's a slide that flags the total amount for socio-economic development and enterprise development a bit later. But if you look at on the right-hand side, it shows you the sectors where this money has been spent. Most of the money has been spent on education and skills development, followed by social welfare, and enterprise development, and then social welfare, health, but that just gives you an idea in terms of where the money is being spent. And our view is that we need to improve this. We can do it better. We can improve on socio-economic development and expenditure. Socio-economic development and enterprise development expenditure by coming up with a much more creative way in terms of the areas where the money should be spent, and then try and guide the expenditure of the money over the duration of the contract. When it comes to local content, we spent to date 41.8 billion. I shouldn't say we spent. I think the project spent to date, and the commitment was 67.1 billion. As you know, that this is still under construction. So, with our own calculation, we believe that actually they've overachieved in this regard, and the project will continue to spend the money on that. Then we spread the project. We created this map to just give you a high-level overview of where these projects are located and how much money rests in those areas where these projects are located. You realize that most of the projects are based in the Northern Cape. That's where most of the money is. Obviously, the other provinces, they also benefit. But this is mainly determined by the fact that the project, they get located where there's a resource. If there's a good wind, and then the project developers will go for the areas where it's a good wind. If there's a good sun or solar radiation, then they will go for the areas with that good solar radiation. There's a slide that explains this and summarize it in all, but this just gives you a sense of how much money goes away from a provincial spread point of view. We looked at the number of projects that we have signed to date, which is 64, and the total cost on those projects is about 142 billion rand. Remember earlier when I mentioned the 208 billion, but that includes the projects that are not signed. If you remove the ones that are not signed, it gives you 142. If you look at the ones that we need to sign, which is the 27 projects, that alone it amounts to 59 billion rand. And then we got the 19 projects, those are not announced. The total cost for that is about 63 billion rand. And then I've mentioned the coal part, which I'm not going to repeat. And then we're also looking at the gas, and we mentioned the cost associated with the gas as well. Just looking at, if we were to look at this going forward and how we should probably looking at the program and how best we could implement it, we believe that technologies will always be changing and you will always have new technologies, and we need to adapt with the changes in technologies. Obviously, we have seen the price of renewable coming down, and we think that would help in alleviating the pressure on the consumer from a pricing point of view, whereby your new generation capacity will actually come at a much lower cost than the old generation capacity. We think that's good news for the consumer. And we also believe that as we go forward, the Electricity Regulation Act on new generation capacity will assist in this regard, because that's where you do the determination in terms of Section 34, and then it helps you to determine what needs to be built. But obviously that needs to be aligned to the IRP to make sure that the consumer always gets the best price for electricity. Obviously, we believe that there shouldn't be an impact on the government balance, or there should be a limited impact on the government balance sheet, but equally so, there shouldn't be an impact on the ESCOM balance sheet, because the cost of renewables or the cost of IPPs, it is a pass-through, as explained in the regulations and also in the Act, which is the Electricity Regulation Act. We believe that the project that we have signed, they've alleviated a lot of strain on the communities where these projects are located, but we believe this could still be improved by adding the new project that we have referred to earlier on, which is the 27 project. And as we look at this, we also had estimation in terms of the number of jobs that will be created. We put the figure there. And also we look at, if we were to look at what we still need to do in terms of the other projects that are not mentioned here in the conclusion, we think the number of jobs that will be created will be much higher. But what we decided to do is that when we calculate our job, we use the DPW calculation so that at least we are aligned in terms of the jobs and in the manner in which we calculate the jobs. I think that's more about it. Okay. The socio-economic development, I was going to skip this one, but I think there's another slide that explains it in more details. I'm still looking forward to that one. I thought it's going to be the next one. Yeah, that's the one. If you look at from 2013 to 2017, you kind of look at the program in five-year windows. You will see how much money for enterprise development, socio-economic development, and community trust dividends. How much money would flow to those communities where these projects are located. We try to analyze the money per five-year window, but if you were to look at that and combine all the monies from day one to the 20-year period, you will get the total figures on your right-hand side. You will see that enterprise development alone, it should amount to about 6.4 billion rand of the signed project to date. If you were to look at that money, just money that needs to go to enterprise development. And when it comes to socio-economic development, in total, that should amount to about 20 billion rand over the 20 years period, 20.5 billion rand. And then community dividends, it's about 29.1 billion rand over the 20 years program. But you can realize that the five-year window, for instance, from 2013 to 2017, probably that has been spent already, in dividends, about 231 million rand that flow to those communities where the projects are located. That money keeps on ramping up every year. As you add more and more projects, the money continues to rise. And also as you pay more debt, because remember they borrowed money to pay to participate, so you, as you pay the debt, your returns from dividends point of view also increases. And then the socio-economic development money, that's the one in the middle that we were referring to say we believe this money can be structured better and we can improve on how this money is used. We can direct it to more specific initiatives that will assist the country, and also we can look at new project that's needed to be developed and start preparing, training people using the socio-economic development money, but that can also be complemented by the enterprise development money, and we structured it in terms of five-year window, how much each of those elements could contribute to South Africa at large. This is a busy slide, but it shows where, how much money in terms of the two, three elements that I've referred to, how much money and its where, in which province, over the duration of the contract. One of the things that we were sort of looking at, we wondered whether continue with the model that allows communities to own projects. Is it the right model or it's not the right model? We ask ourselves these questions. And we also look at the governance of the community trust, how best we can improve that, and how best can we make sure that the community, they start benefiting from the dividends. If you own stake in the project, how best can you quickly benefit from the dividends? And we look at the number of structuring mechanisms that could assist in making sure that the community, they don't wait for a very long time before they can get money out of the project, and we're working on all those different initiatives to try and make sure that we assist the communities as best as we can. I think that's the slide, the main point that we want to make on that slide. It is that if you look at the spread, we spread this money in terms of the different bid windows. So we looked at community participation, we look at BEE participation, we look at equity in general, we look at the project cost. So this just gives you a sense of how much each window is and how much is the BEE participation in each and every window, and the community participation as well. I made the point earlier on about two issues, which is climate change, which is environment, and also water savings. I think this just reiterates the same point, that the program is playing a critical role from a climate change point of view, and also from a water saving point of view. If you look at what we have calculated to date, we believe we reduced about around 17.25 million tons of COD from December to date. And also we look at water, how much water we would have saved to date. But I think the point we are making is that in everything that we are doing, we are looking at making sure that the environment is not negatively affected, and we're also making sure that we save water for the country, because we are a water-scarce country. I think, Chair, it was a long presentation. I've tried to summarize.
Thank you so much, Mr. Ngobeni, for the comprehensive presentation. It's long, but it's interesting. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, honorable members, let me acknowledge Mr. Natazo from NASA. Honorable members, we are now on that item to interact with the presentation. It's the time for questions, clarity-seeking questions and comments. Thank you, Honorable Matlala.
Thank you, Acting Chair. The presenter, as she was presenting the presentation, he was sometimes referring to, he will skip some of the slides to say, I'll come back to them and explain in details. As I was listening to him, he didn't went back to some of those slides to explain that particular slides in details. It's unfortunate I was not noting some of those slides, but I was just listening to you. Even some of the slides now, you said it is on the other slide. The other slide explained this other one in details. And you know, we're listening to you and you didn't say anything about it. For sure you'll explain in details. You have written them down. To Chair, this project, how much did you budget for this project, the entire project? How much is it? The other one, Chair, how is your relationship with ESCOM and SALGA? Because these are the key role players for you to achieve your program. On the slides, I don't know what is this slide, but it's page 3, the last one. Aligned energy policies and national planning context. You made mention that some of the things are not achieved between public and private energy markets. Can you provide us with the reasons why these things are not achieved? The other one, Chair, relates to, you see, I'm coming from a rural province called Limpopo and Sekhukhune area. Listeresis, where Listeresis comes from. No, I'm not from Polokwane. That one comes is free. it's not me, Chair, it's my colleague here. It's a dam called the Huob Dam. This dam was there for some years. And the communities there can't access water, because I'm told the report we have is that municipalities in the area, in particular the district, is owing Eskom lot of billions and billions of money. So Eskom cannot pump water to various areas, villages. And what are the reasons? The municipalities are owing Eskom. Is there any other intervention that you, as a project, the project can intervene to make sure that these villages get water within a short space of time, because it has been there for quite a long time? And how much are these municipalities owing Eskom? This is a song. We've been singing this song for sure before the minister, Jeff Hadebe, was appointed as a minister. The previous ministers were singing this song. Up to today, for sure, it's still the same song. You made mention of the cross-border selling power to neighboring countries. How is South Africa benefiting from this project? Do you employ the South Africans who have skills also to take part in the whole processes of this cross-border power issue? You spoke of saving water, but here in Cape Town, we are in trouble. This project is saving water, but we don't have water here in Cape Town. It's one of the things that you said, but you'll give us some reasons. How do you save water in Cape Town? We don't have water here. You made mention of there is a direct jobs. Is it page 14, the first slide? That there is a 34,841 direct job that you have created in various provinces, the whole nine provinces. I want to know which municipalities in those provinces, because if you are saying Limpopo, I'm not sure whether you are speaking of Tsingitsingi from Giyani in Mopani region, or Vembe, or Umkhathu, what is this other region in KwaZulu-Natal? Mkhanyakude. We might not be sure as whether it's Mkhanyakude in KwaZulu-Natal, but you said KwaZulu-Natal. Where in KwaZulu-Natal? Can you tell us the... Am I not on your behalf, comrades? I'm sorry. That I must come to job. I'm not sleeping on job here while working. The other one, Chair, which is very interesting, it's an amendment which was published in the Government Gazette of 10 November 2017. And it was signed by the former Energy Minister, Mrs. Kubai Ngubane. And who occupied the position ahead of the Honorable Minister David Mashobo, who himself has since been removed as a minister and replaced by the Honorable Mr. Jeff Hadebe. In fact, the amendment was initiated during the time of the former minister Tina Jumat Peterson. According to the specialist of energy, lawyer Sui Ross, he said his argument is that the amendment reduces the scope of those generation activities that can be exempt from licensing. It also raises new uncertainties, which could delay the implementation of independent power producer project. Furthermore, he argues that a key area of uncertainty relates to the need to register exempt project with the National Energy Regulator of South Africa. What does this statement tell us? Can you unpack this statement? Because some of us who are We're not specialist energy. Can you tell us what does this thing mean? The other one, Chair, relates to, it's unfortunate that DG of the department is not here. Huh? Oh, is he back? Oh, I thought he's still on the other side. Oh, I'm sorry, DG. You survived the storm. If they reshuffle this one, you go. When they appoint this one, you come with the other one. You are very fortunate. Thank you very much. My apology, DG. I thought you are... Yeah. Thank you. Oh, and one chair. I want the department to update the committee on the financial status of the IPP office and whether integrating the IPP office into FEV is still under consideration. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. My concern is we have moved from one of the most successful renewable energy IPP procurement programs in the world to a deadlock with this department, Department of Energy. We've drawn investments of more than 200 billion rand, 193 if I'm not mistaken, exactly to a trickle. It is, where do we go from here? We... the minister, the previous minister, Minister Kubai, Ms. Kubai, that was here before, she said in the budget vote speed there's uncertainty around the IPP program. We need to evaluate whether this program is assisting us. Are we achieving our objectives in the field? What has changed? What has changed? The minister, after Mr. Minister Mashlova, did not much elaborate during his short spell. Is it still, are we still sitting at this between 77 cents a kilowatt hour? Is this still set that they must come in at this? I'm sorry, I'm fighting around. Very few of the projects, very few of the last projects, so although we, I'm driving industries as well, and we emphasize on locally built and public procurement, very few large projects are built here. It's a problem not that the larger projects in this country are foreignly built. That's not one of the issues here. We have the technology and the space and everything in this country to do that. The department in the previous financial year kept on adding on coal-fired capacity, very little. Why is this department, why is the renewables, why did you spend up to near over 70% of your budget was not spent on renewable energy? Why is this, is a, you know, is the first fundamental issue here not an absence of objective and up-to-date energy planning, maybe at national level, but affecting this department? The Department of Energy on a national agenda are not putting the national agenda ahead of their own agenda by not by undermining Eskom, or the thinking they are undermining Eskom's monopoly in energy supplying. Is that not holding back renewable energy? The gas pipeline that the honourable member was speaking about, that's owned by Sasol. It's not even owned by Sasol, own and maintain that. So who the price determinations on this? Who sets this? Can Eskom at this stage provide grid access for IPP? The integrated source plan does not really address access to the grid. Although transmission was included in the last or the last IRP. You know, grid planning cannot be an afterthought. We have to accommodate thousands of small-scale producers. The source of power is shifting completely from these big coal power stations and to centralized cities now, from smaller scales now. How are you going to accommodate this? Small-scale residential power generation from solar could account for as much as 50 gigawatts in the very near future, I see it. But the contribution is retarded by a lack of policy and regulation. There's not really policy and regulation adding this the very department for all these small-scale producers.
Thank you, Honourable F. Daisy and Honourable Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much to the Department and the IPP Office for being here and for updating us on this important program. I want to start with the delay in the signing of the PPAs for the 27 projects. As far as I understand, Lynn Brown, the former Minister of Public Enterprises, signed the proclamations on the 1st of February. So a month has passed. Could you give us a date for when you expect the signing to take place, and can you tell us what the key sticking points are that are delaying it? There's reports that around $15 billion, it's about just under 200 billion rand, was invested in the renewable sector from 2011 until it was stalled. Could you tell us how much potential investment has been lost to South Africa due to the stalling of this program? Have you calculated a figure that you can tell us so we can see what the cost of the delay was? And I think that's very important for us to know as a committee. Also, I think one of my colleagues also mentioned this, but will the IPP office still be moving to the Central Energy Fund? What is the progress with that? And can you just tell us what is the thinking behind the decision or the proposal to move the IPP office to the Central Energy Fund? And what are the possible benefits of moving the IPP office? Then you mentioned in the presentation that the IRP had been approved by Cabinet. We've also heard that, but we don't know it for certain because we haven't seen the IRP gazetted, and even the press release that came out from that Cabinet meeting didn't mention anything about a new IRP. We've just heard from the former Minister, Mashlobo, just before the Energy Indaba, that there was an approval, but there's been no concrete evidence of it. Ironically, Minister Kubayi, when she was Minister, said that we would have a new IRP. She set the deadline for the end of February. When Minister Mashlobo came in, he said it must be done yesterday, and from what we hear, you guys are working around the clock in back rooms and on weekends and till midnight trying to get this thing done. But we're in March now, and we still haven't seen the IRP. Can you tell us what is the holdup in gazetting the IRP? Because it's really unclear to us and really confusing to watch from the outside the constant mixed messages we're getting about the IRP. And you mentioned in the presentation that you're moving ahead according to the new IRP, but of course it hasn't been gazetted, so nobody's had an opportunity to even interrogate what that IRP is. But what we have heard is that the new IRP retains nuclear at the expense of gas and renewables. And this is despite the CSIR and ESCOM's own modeling throwing out nuclear when you look at it from the least cost base case scenario. So maybe you can shed some light to this committee, because we weren't able to get any sense from the previous minister. Can you explain why the department appears to be resolutely sticking with nuclear? Or will this change now that we have a new minister? What are your expectations in that regard? Then, on job creation, you mentioned in your presentation that the 27 projects will create just under 60,000 jobs, and that is something to really be celebrated and something that we can really all get behind. Have you done a study on whether the building of a new nuclear power station would create as many jobs as that? Is that comparative study being done so that we can analyze that decision from a job creation perspective and a local economic development perspective? Then just on the independence of the IPP office, you mentioned in the presentation that the IPP office is funded through a percentage of total costs of the signed projects. How has the delay in the signing of these projects impacted on the IPP office? If you can actually break it down for us in specifics and in numbers, what has it meant to your financial sustainability? And on financial sustainability, you said that you need a more sustainable model, but you didn't really outline what that model would look like. And I think it's important for us to understand what you mean by the more sustainable model, and if it means more direct state funding, how would you do that without impacting on the independence of the office? Because obviously he who pays the piper calls the tune. So you find yourself in a very difficult situation there. You've had the delays of the contracts being signed, which has impacted on your sustainability, which might force you then to be funded by the state, which would then impact on your independence. So can you just give us your sense of how that's going to work? Chair, I've just got two more questions. The smalls program, I think I certainly have some concern about the smalls program. It doesn't seem to be mentioned with the same kind of urgency as the other programs. But I see that in the presentation that there's been no Section 54 approval by the Department of Public Enterprises, and there's been no Section 66 and 70 approval by the Minister of Finance. Can you tell us why these approvals haven't been granted and what the hold-up is there for the smalls program for emerging independent producers? And then lastly, on coal, I think you rightly in your presentation spoke about clean energy and the need for clean energy, and I don't think anybody in this room would disagree with that. But can you then tell us why we're going ahead with coal IPPs, especially since Kusile and Medupi still have units to come online? We already have an over-reliance on coal in our energy mix. Surely we should be focusing on gas and renewables for the IPPs going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation, and apologies for being late, Chairperson. I also share the same sentiments with regards to the IPP office integrating into the CFF funding. So I think we'd like to understand more information with regards to that and what is the current status quo. And also it was mentioned in the presentation about the fact that this IPP office will be doing the advisory support on an ongoing basis to the Department of Energy. But I'm just interested in terms of the challenges, because when I read the report, it mentions quite a lot of challenges. And I'm very much interested to understand how are you going to make sure that you address those challenges and then you are doing your job as mandated. And then in terms of socio-economic transformation and development, and the presenter mentioned specifically with regards to solar water heater program. We know this program is not doing well in terms of the department. It's failing our people, especially in the rural areas. So I'd like to understand what is it that the program is going to do different to make sure the situation is changing. And And then in terms of, to add to what my colleague has said with regards to jobs, I would like to understand that how many permanent positions, because I know that if you are using the calculation by Department of Public Works, the EPWP, which is a three-month job, and I know that it is being classified as a job and that the person is not working at the moment. So I would like to understand how many permanent positions have been created and the contract and everything. And you said, especially in the rural areas, I would like to understand exactly the province, even though I think in your presentation you mentioned Northern Cape, and I assume maybe mostly from the Northern Cape, I'm not sure. But I think the interest for me is for each province, how many jobs, permanent jobs, contract jobs have been
established. And then in line with this, I would like to link the community empowerment, because for me it will be useless if you can go and develop a community and then the people from that community are not benefiting economically. And especially I want to say this with regard to slide 37 on page 19, with the challenges that you have mentioned, that there's a lot of community challenges. What is the current situation? Because I know you are busy in those areas. And how are you overcoming those challenges with regard to community engagement and empowerment? And lastly, what do you mean by full-time equivalent job? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Gata. Over to you, Ms. Honorable Mabunda.
Thanks, Chair. You said it's a time for questions and comments. Mine is not a question. I think most of members here covered me in many questions, but you will choose whether it's a complaint or an advice to say the font is too small for some of us, because you just present and, well, I'm struggling to read, but I can't read. And sometimes when people want you not to ask questions, they write in very small font and prolong the presentation so that you must not ask. But I'm just asking for improvement on font so that we were able to read and ask questions. Thanks. Yes, I'm getting.
Thank you, Honorable Munda. Any other questions or comments, Honorable Members? Okay, I'll hand over to Ms. Ngobeni or Ms.
The point on font I'm taking, because I could even see on the screen sometimes the color doesn't work. So next time I will make sure that we put it on the screen first and just check that we can all read and understand the color. So thank you for that. I agree with that. So, and apologies. I want to take some of the points, but then Maduna will also have to fill in. The socioeconomic development part of our work, in my opinion, is almost the most important part. What we did get right was to get the price of electricity down. But the development of the communities and our people, I don't think we have done the best job. And I don't want to make excuses for it, but when we started the program, we thought if we got 10 projects, it would be a massive achievement. The first round, we received 52 submissions, never mind projects. And I think what happened after that is the program has snowballed, and we are basically catching up from behind. In the meeting this morning, I tried to explain that looking at the future, there is a lot more that we need to do to get our own people up to speed and to be able to participate. And I think we can do it. We just need to sit down, plan properly, agree with the department, come back and tell you, and then you can monitor us as to the outcome of what we are trying to do. Obviously, this program is now, 7 years? And we started really from by zero. But we have learned a lot, and I think it is now time to plow back. And while we didn't sign, haven't signed for the last 2 years, we spent a lot of time in thinking, how can we do things better? What should we implement? How should we report on things? How should we go to the communities and get their needs? I mean, one big thing that we haven't thought about, the moment when there's money in a community, there's an influx of people. What will happen to the infrastructure in that community? Will the community be ready to handle so much money? you can see we haven't thought through those things because we never expected this amount of money to be available. And therefore, it's time to sit back, talk to the department, and work out how do we help these communities to get the benefit of what we what the intention was in the beginning. So I have to acknowledge, this is not perfect, but I really believe it is a good a base to go to continue. I think where, and I mentioned it this morning, where we made the mistake as South Africa, this stop-start thing, it doesn't work. If we want to develop people, we need to give them an opportunity to start with round one, to go into round two, to do round three, because your first round is where you learn. The second round is where you start applying. The third round is where you can really say, I can now participate without somebody holding my hand. And that is what we haven't done well. We stop, start. We never knew, are we going to continue, are we not going to continue. I think it is not right for South Africa, it's not right for investment, but it's definitely not right for our people. And until we take this as a serious opportunity to develop our people and to make our people to grow, until then we will not achieve what was set out in the beginning to achieve. And I think this can happen. I remember when we sold this program to Minister Pravin in the beginning, his views were, you're doing electricity, you're not doing socioeconomic development. However, he allowed us to do this part which we have got in South Africa, where we do socioeconomic development together with the program. And I think if you look now back and see what is available to the country to do proper socioeconomic development and upliftment, I think it's really a very positive story. I know last year there was about 100 bursaries given to kids in the Dar area. Now that's a huge achievement, and our bursary is not only books and registration and etc. Our bursaries look after the kids with clothing, food, paying for their fees, etc. and giving them a mentor while they are at university or TVET to make sure that they grow and achieve their objectives. So, yes, we are learning, and it's definitely not perfect, but I believe if we support this, it can grow into something that can really be a big game changer for South Africa. The one that I want to answer is, what did the delays do to us as the IPP office? Of course, this has hit us extremely hard. And, of course, we would like to stay out of the pocket, if I can say like that, of the government. What the Treasury did last year, they basically told DBSA to allow us to continue even if we do not have money. So there was a letter written from Treasury to the DBSA to ask them for us to continue. Now, we haven't hit that point, but DBSA has also offered twice. Once, money to pay for our consultants, and the second time that they offered was to pay for our operational costs, because they believe that the capacity that sits in the IPP office shouldn't just be disappearing. And if the energy sector doesn't need this capacity, there may be other sectors like water that may need now capacity to bring in the private sector to help with the investment in the water sector. I'm just using it as an example. I'm not saying this is where we should be going, but at least we have got a core competency that we have built. The other thing is, we have appointed lots of young professionals, black young professionals, and those are the ones that are currently most jittery, because they have got young families. They can't stay there not knowing that they have got money to pay for their houses, their cars, etc. And therefore, this thing about whether you institutionalize us or whether you decide for this thing to continue, but then extend the mandate for a little bit longer. I think it's a very serious issue that we need to discuss. The DG wasn't in the office for a while, and I mean, as we did not try to explain to you, we got the solar water heater program, and then it wasn't us anymore, and then suddenly it is us again. It's not good, because it's again stop, but in the meantime, whatever we have done has basically stopped for I don't know, 9 months. And now suddenly we're back scrambling and getting all the youngsters who we have trained and tried to make them part of the program again. So I just think we are not thinking about proper doing things in terms of our economy, our youth, and our people. You cannot run an economy if you want to stop every time that there's something happening. You have to find a way to get around it. And then if I can plea for something is allow us maybe the pace slower, but allow us to continue and to do what we're supposed to do and to come back to you and report. If you don't feel we're not doing our job, then tell us that. And then you can fire us. But if you think we can do it better, tell us also, and we're happy to listen and to take what you are saying to us on board. So now I'm going to leave to Medina to do the deep dive.
Thanks, Karin. I'm going to try and answer the question, start with Honorable Masala's question. The slide, apologies, I think when I got to the slide where I was supposed to explain, maybe I should have flagged that this is what I was referring to. Apologies. I tried to explain everything. It's just that I didn't link it back to the slides that I've omitted. I think I remember very well it was more about the SED money, and it's a slide that got the total SED money and also the amount of money that's available in a five-year window kind of thing. And the issue about how much did we budget for, I think it relates to the point that Karen has made. We don't get money from the budget. So the money that we use is money that we get from development fees when we close projects, and then that money gets into a ring-fence account, which sits at Treasury, and that's the only money that we can spend. We can't spend anything outside of that. So so there's no budget allocation whatsoever. And what we've achieved and why we didn't achieve in slide 3, I think the thinking there was that the white paper, it's a document with a lot of policies in it. Probably members would remember that around 2002, there was a process that was initiated to restructure the sector, and that was also part of the white paper. And I think around that time, there was also the regional electricity distributors. That was also part of dealing with the white paper recommendations. But some of those things, there were challenges in them. We're not necessarily involved in the implementation of it, but there were challenges, and some of the proposals were challenged, and it never really materialized. Obviously, of course, there should be a new thinking into it, but I think there were a lot of attempts to deal with those issues. You mentioned something about the dam in Limpopo. I think, of course, there is an issue about water. I will link this to the Cape Town water as well, because you raised it, it was raised. Obviously, I mean, we are not necessarily too close to what's happening there in that particular dam and the issues pertaining to that particular dam. We don't know. I suppose the only thing I can say is that we can have a look and check what's happening there. Obviously, this is an area that is kind of outside of our scope per se, but we can find out. Maybe when we come back, we can give some guidance in terms of what we have seen there. In terms of cross-border, I think it's important to note that we haven't procured anything on cross-border. We don't have any project on cross-border. There was a determination of 3,700 something megawatts allocated, but we did not procure it. Obviously, when we engage into cross-border procurement, we got to understand certain things, and we got to have our own requirement as a country in terms of what do we expect to get out of that. One of the things that we thought of is that if we do a cross-border procurement, it could be that part of the requirement is that certain services should be utilized from our country. For instance, let's say the procurement of certain things should be done from our country. But I suppose that's something that we need to analyze, unpack it, and make sure that we understand it properly before we go to the market. So those are issues that are on our radar screen when we do cross-border project. Water savings, we flag what we believe the program has saved to date, but it's a very minimum amount of water. It wouldn't change probably the status of the water supply in Cape Town, but definitely it will assist going forward. I suppose as we roll out the program broadly link it back to water, it could have a positive impact in the long run. We do note the fact that the whole coastal area would have water challenges in one way or the other. But at the moment, what we looked at from the electricity side. There was only one project where we also looked at water. It was the gas program. We thought of combining gas to power projects with water desalination. We did look at that as one of the things that we could do going forward. There was an issue about the IPP office moving to SAF. Yes, that announcement was made some time ago, but from where we're sitting, we haven't seen anything that says this is how it's going to work. I think it's safe to say at this point there's no indication that the office will be moving to SAF. Yes, there was a deadlock about with IPPs and SAF. I think this was raised, and also the 77-cent issue. We discussed these issues and we engaged with the department as well with regards to the 77-cent and also the procurement issues related to doing so. And I think after all the engagement, there was an agreement that there is no need to look at the 77-cent. We should go ahead with the project as they stand. However, if certain projects are willing to offer lower tariffs, we could accept that, but it's not mandatory that it should be like that, because if you immediately want to do that, you get into procurement issues. However, our engagement and negotiations with the IPPs, because the letter of undertaking does allow us to negotiate to a certain extent, value for money, we negotiated for more economic transformation, which means more black participation was negotiated, and the number was increased from what it was at bid submission to a much higher level. If I remember very well, I think Karen will remind me, I think now we're sitting at around black participation sitting around 51% of the South African participation, and also the South African participation, we should remember, it also includes state-owned companies in it. So there's a much higher black participation in the program as compared to at bid submission. There was an issue about the coal, keeping adding coal into the grid instead of renewables. Yes, the implementation is in accordance with the IRP as it stands. Any deviation to the IRP is always challenging. However, the IRP as it stands does allude to the fact that there should be coal. But our view is that we want to focus only on the project that we have procured to date. We're not talking about any other new coal other than the ones that we have procured. once we have resolved the ones that we have procured, we can then look at how best do we have this mix going forward. But the IRP will be key in guiding that energy mix going forward. There was an issue about Sasol pipeline. Our scope does not necessarily deal with Sasol pipelines, but we do realize that if we were to do gas into the energy mix, we need to look at the gas infrastructure in totality. And the Sasol gas pipelines as well, it's part of the infrastructure that we'll have to look at. And we do know that the pipeline between Sasol or Secunda and Richards Bay or Durban, it actually belongs to Transnet. So it should be easier in the long term, even though probably the regulator will speak to this one much better, even though we understand it's a concession, so the concession is valid for a particular period of time. So we are not in the social space, but our thinking is that we will have to integrate this thing at some point when we implement the gas program. And the access to the grid and the IRP, the planning, and also the fact that the grid planning is not necessarily aligned to the IRP. Yes, it is true, and I think that alignment needs to be improved from time to time. If members remember that way back when we spoke about the ISMO, the Independent Transmission and System Operator, one of the things that was raised there, it was the alignment, and that we need to look at the grid planning, and we need to look at the IRP, and we need to make sure that those two are aligned to make sure that the infrastructure is supports the development of projects. And you also mentioned something about which municipalities where these jobs are created. I think we can send a slide on that. We do have, it's not just not in this presentation, but we do have jobs per municipality, per province. I think we do have that. We can definitely share that information. You also mentioned something about amendment to Schedule 2 of the Electricity Regulation Act. Yes, in 2017, I think it was November, the minister promulgated an amendment to that. I think the point of the amendment is to try and facilitate the investment in the sector and also try to align whatever that is being built with the IRP. Because at the moment of the Act, what it says is that if you build for own use, you don't have to be licensed. So what that means is that we wouldn't even know how much own use generation capacity is out there as a country. So what this does, it says, yes, you can build your own use, but if you are above a particular limit, I think it's 1 megawatt, you need to get the regulator to register you, for instance. So that what it does, it allows the regulator to have access to what capacity is available and how much own use is available out there, so that at least they can tell. Because once you got the information about the own use, you can bring it back to the planning platform to say, given there's so much megawatts that has been built for own use, therefore I don't have to cater for it in my plans because this one is already catered for. Otherwise, if you don't do that, you've got this mixed match. At the end of the day, you might find that you've got access generation capacity, or you assume you're going to have own use of so much, but you don't get that. So it was mainly a point of alignment when it comes to that. And then the financial status of the IPP office, I think Karin spoke to that. Embedded generation and the small solar scale, I think I suppose this is the rooftops. We look at, when in our space, when we talk about embedded generation, we look at smaller generators that are between 1 and 5 megawatts. That's what we procure. Anything beyond that, it's outside of our mandate from a procurement point of view. However, we do recognize that rooftops as embedded generation is something that we need to look at as a country, and we need to have the necessary policies to make sure that that is implemented in an efficient and effective way and must be aligned to the planning process as well, because it's important that we align the two so that we are not out of sync of the other. Honorable Davis, you also made a comment about the date of signing. What are the constraints? I think Karin mentioned some of them. Yes, it is true that at this point, I think if you look at the table, there's a table in the presentation that outlines what approvals we got. I think at this point, if we talk about 3.5 and 4, we do have all the approvals that are required. So it's an issue of our principal sitting down, facilitating the dates, and make sure that we can sign by a particular date. Remember, when we sign, we need all the parties there. So we need to align ESCOM, we need to align the Department of Energy, so that the relevant people who will sign the contract, who are mandated to do so, they are available on that particular date to make sure that the signing happens. So obviously from an ESCOM side as well, before they sign, there are certain things that they go through them, even themselves. They need to make sure that the board resolution is in place and everything that relates to giving the person who should sign the mandate to do so, it's sorted to the delegations. I suppose I can't talk to the ESCOM internal processes in terms of delegating those who should be signing on how far that process is, but our understanding, we think most of the processes has been sorted. The only thing that is outstanding now is the signing date. And then how much potential investment and impact on the of the delay? Obviously, we haven't quantified how much would have done should the delay were not there. I suppose that it also relates to how much megawatt we should have procured so that we got a sense of how much would have done over the duration of the time. But that's an element of the IRP, because the IRP needs to say this is how much is required, and then if we were to do it according to it, this is what we would have done. So we didn't do that, but what we have quantified, we quantified what we have procured to date. I think that those figures are available, and some of them actually are in the presentation, those that we haven't signed, and the amount of money that could come from that, and the job numbers that could come from the project that we have signed, and the ones that we haven't announced, I think, is also covered. The minister did announce that IRP was approved, but I don't think as an office we are privy to that information. We are also, the minister, I think, can talk to that probably. Yeah, the DG will speak to it. For our role is to procure as guided by the department. The whole jobs and nuclear versus IRP and which one does more jobs, I think we haven't done that study. Our focus is more about what we have determinations for and what we can do as an office. And how the delays impacted on the IPP office, I think Karin explained that. And the sustainability of the funding model, how will this work, funding by the state, and whether it would not compromise the independence of the office. We, at this point, our view is that if the program moves the way it's expected to move, funding shouldn't be an issue. But obviously, once there's a delay in the program and it's a start-stop in the program, that will have an impact. Because everything that we do it based on the projections that and the amount of work that we expected to do. And also, if we look at the program, it got two elements in it. You got the monitoring part, which is the 20-year period. Then you got the procurement part, which is the short-term process. But the short-term process is well covered for. I think what we receive from the project can deal with that. But now the contract management over a 20-year period, I think that needs to be dealt with in our view. But obviously, what funding model should be developed, I suppose that talks to the institutionalization of the IPP office itself. If it gets institutionalized, And then that funding model as well can be dealt with in the, because at least, as you know, that the constitution requires that any, if you, because you can impose a levy, for instance, like the regulator is funded to say so much should go to the monitoring of the contracts, but that will then require an act to do that. You can't do it any other way. So there are mechanisms in which you could do it without necessarily having to get money from the government, but you need to put legislation in place to do that. The small projects are a concern to us as well, given that most of the people who are participating under the small project is small companies with smaller balance sheets, so the impact is much severe on them as compared to the bigger projects. Because the bigger project is people with much stronger balance sheets, they can handle the delays. Yet small projects, they cannot handle those delays. But we should also note that we did the small project after between the 3.5 and 4. So you wouldn't have all the approvals for it. But also the fact that once there is a delay in signing between the 3.5 and 4, then everybody started getting cold feet because, you know, why should you continue with the other one if the other one's not moving? So it's like, get this one moving first before you can even talk about other things. And I think that's what created the challenges. And so that's what created the challenges, and that's the reason why you see that from an approval point of view, the small project is slightly behind than the rest. But I think once we have signed the 3.5 and 4, it should be easier now to start dealing with the small projects from an approval point of view. Then you made a point about coal and gas. Why should we do coal? Why shouldn't we do gas? Our view is that the IRP, it does give guidance. I'm cognizant of the fact that we still need to look at the new one. But if you look at the system as a whole, the IRP, it helps you to pull together the different technologies in a balanced manner because the system needs to be balanced. The system, if you do your planning, the system will tell you what you need. Do you need a coal baseload or you need gas? Most of the time, gas, we need it so that we can balance the renewables because gas, it got a much quicker ramp up. But if it's a base load that you need, if you put both gas and renewables, still you don't get that base load from a system point of view, then you need to look at coal or anything else that will give you a stable generation profile. And Honorable Ngata, the IPP office is still going to serve. I think I dealt with that one on a previous response. And then challenges and how would these challenges be addressed as outlined. I think Karin raised or mentioned the fact that we are looking at different alternatives. Most of the challenges are at the community level, and most of the challenges is to do with the fact that communities, they want to benefit from the project as early as possible. And we believe, yes, it's true, they have to benefit as early as possible. Therefore, we need to look at different mechanisms of ensuring that they benefit as soon as possible. Because if we look at the dividends stream, dividends, they don't flow as quickly as one would like them to flow. You need to pay first the debt, and then after that you can start having dividends flow. But if we were to look at a different funding structure that would change the way in which that revenue stream flows, probably could help the communities to start benefiting early, and they can then spend the money on what they believe is appropriate. But equally so, the social economic development as well, we can restructure that. The money is there, but we can redirect it, and we can engage with the IPP in terms of redirecting that money and direct it to areas where we feel, or where the community feels it's important to spend the money there. So it's a matter of engagement, and it's also a matter of engaging the IPPs as well in terms of the expenditure and make sure that the money is spent on right things, on things that will make a difference to the community. The solar water heater program, how would it be done differently? We our program, it focuses mainly on the repair and replace. That's what we focus on. And we did a lot of high-level studies, engaging with the community to try and understand what are the challenges related to that program. And we picked up that some of the issues is that, firstly, we find that the system itself was not installed properly, or the system itself is installed on the roof that is not properly supported. You will find that the installation probably is not installed in a manner that would sustain this thing in a longer period of time. So we looked at all those things, but out of everything, we realized that probably about 80% of the system, they're still working. They might be having difficulties there and there, but if you were to do proper maintenance on them, they would continue to work. And then the other 20%, obviously, is either the roof, it's not capable of handling it at all. You know, then you've got to remove it for safety purposes and see whether you can support the roof and continue to install a new one with the view that the roof now is supported and can handle it. And I think the partnership between ourselves and the IPP, I think it worked very well in terms of the solar water heater program, and also allowing them to support us with the training, and also allowing them to support us with the implementation only on the repair and replace. I think I should mention that. That's what we cover at this point. And how many jobs are permanent? The issue of jobs is always a contentious issue, because on how you calculate jobs, it's an issue of making sure that your formula, it doesn't allow for slippages in the process. Because if we're saying we want full-time jobs, we can say, tell us how many people have been employed full-time. But we need to define what is full-time. If you're employed for 1 year, is that full-time? If you're employed for 3 years, is that full-time? If you're employed for 5 years, is that full-time? But what we did, we thought we should look at the number of hours that a person has performed in that particular entity. Then it's the hours that we look at. You can have 15 or 500 people employed in 1 day, but when we count the number of hours that those people have spent in your facility, that amounts to one job, for example, despite the fact that you have 500, because we look at the hours, not the head of people that are there. Because you can have 500 just for 1 day, then you say, no, I've created 500 jobs. That's not 500 jobs, you know. When we add the hours up, it will amount to one job. So I think the point I was making is that we calculate the hours and translate the hours into jobs rather than just counting the head, because the head could be misleading at some point. And empowering communities, I've spoken about this one a lot. We believe the communities need to be empowered, they need to be involved in the project. That's why earlier on we spoke about the SED and ED money, which could go to the communities and also focus on the areas where we're still going to develop projects, so that we train the communities to empower them to participate effectively when the project starts getting implemented. Because to expect the project to empower the community while the project is already in motion, it's sometimes problematic. They will empower you. By the time you are empowered, everything is complete, it's finished. You are empowered, but you can't do anything. And you cannot take the person that has been trained by one project on the other side and move them to the other communities, because you create tension as well within the communities. Each community expects you to train people where the project is located. If the project is located in my community, I expect my community to benefit, not the person has been trained on another community somewhere else. So we try to avoid that and expect each and every area to have its own people that work on that particular project. Karen mentioned, Honorable Mabunda, Karen mentioned the fund issue. I also agree. I think we need to look at the coloring, and we need to make sure that the colors, they correspond with the area where we're going to be presenting. Because when you got lights like this and you got presentation projected in a particular way, some colors doesn't work well. Thank you very much. I hope I answered all the questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ngobeni and Ms. Bredenbach. You've answered all the questions, although some are beyond your scope and mandate, but you tried your best. Honorable members, I am going to give you follow-up questions, but I want a DG to come up before you. I will give it. Thank you. Over to you, Mr. Zubu.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, for your questions. I think there are some questions that they relate mainly to the department, particularly in relation to the signing, which is a matter that has been outstanding for quite some time with different executive authorities in charge. We have communicated already this matter to our new minister, Honorable Chair and Members, and the matter is receiving a very, very urgent attention. There will also be another session for the first time with our new minister, whereby we'll be taking him through the IPP program as a whole so that he can develop a better insight about how this program has been working, how it has benefited the energy space, and what is the current arrangement in place that needed to be looked into as a matter of urgency. Chair, without risking misleading the Parliament, which is something that we note very carefully these days, I think the issue of signing is a principal matter. I don't think it's an issue. If you have noticed the consistency of the previous ministers, it's a consistency matter. I think it's the modalities that have been required to be dealt with sufficiently and the signing then takes place. I think Honorable Davis has raised the issue around sticking issues that could have delayed the finalization. But there's never been a point in my capacity as the accounting officer and the DG of the department where there's been an issue about signing as a matter of principle, but it has been how to deal with the sticking points that you have made reference to. Amongst those sticking points was the issue of financial modeling. How do you make sure that the financial modeling is sustainable for the IPP program, but equally so because ESCOM has a very vital strategic role to play to make sure that the power purchase agreements that are supposed to be signed as the off-taker, that is done eventually. It's my view, Chair, and it's my personal view that this matter will receive the attention it deserves. We have already, from the department side, arranged a meeting with the Minister of Public Enterprises. Again, Chair, it's a new minister, as you'll understand, and our minister to deal with this matter specifically. And I'm sure when the minister comes here, or before he even comes here, the matter could have been dealt with and the signing issue could have been resolved. And the date that Honorable Davis is looking for will definitely be communicated. So probably even before the next meeting of this committee happens, that could have been resolved because those meetings are expected to happen as a matter of high priority. To share with the committee as early as this afternoon, we will be briefing our new minister on the IPP program as a whole. Amongst the items on the agenda is the issue of the signing of the window 3.5-3.4. The sticking point, Honorable Chairperson and members, has been that the issue of 3.5 and 4 windows, from a DOE perspective, and I think from the IPP office, it's a matter that is outside our scope because there are legal issues that are involved, there are financial commitments that have been made. However, if there's an appetite to review the financial modeling to make sure that all parties involved, ESCOM, DOE as a policy, and IPP, and the private sector investment that is already in the market space, it's not lost, is to look into that beyond bin windows 4, because the commitments have already been made. So that has always been the position of the DOE, and for as long as I've known, that position has never shifted. But in the briefing session that we'll be having with our new minister, we'll also be reflecting on that. So that's why I'm saying I doubt if the whole issue of signing for me will be a challenge. I think it's a matter of saying when and how do we make sure it's done and it's done properly at the right time in the right place with the relevant institutions involved and agreement reached. So we will come back to the committee with that and we'll communicate with the honourable members. If the date for the signing is issued before the next meeting, we'll make sure that is communicated to all members accordingly. Having moved to that issue of signing, Chair, the issue of IRP, I think it is correct from what I've gathered within a short space of time being back in the department that the process was approved by Cabinet in December. However, Honourable Davis is correct that it has not been gazetted. I've been trying to read the minutes of the Cabinet. Having met with the former acting DG, there are some issues that whilst the RP was approved, that Cabinet has raised on the matter. And again, we would like to brief our Minister on this matter and see how the certain issues that have been raised or concerns or considerations that were made are to be accommodated whilst even the RP process is approved. I will assume, again, Honourable Davis, I will assume that one of the reasons why maybe the gazetting did not take place was to consider maybe some of the concerns that were raised by Cabinet, though it was approved, I will assume. We have to look into that. We have to look into issues that were raised. We have to brief our new executive authority on that, our Honourable Minister Jeff Hadebe, and get some guidance to it. But it is correct that it has not been gazetted. It is further correct that certain various concerns were raised on the matter, and again, would like to deal with the matter with our Honourable Minister. We have partially engaged with him last week on the matter, but there was more detail required that we needed to put him into speed around the IRP process. So I'm sure that guidance will be provided in due course. And I think once all those considerations and issues raised by Cabinet, though it was approved, have been taken care of, I think maybe the gazetting process might then kick in. It's my analysis, Honourable David. The last issue that we have raised, again, is around the issue of nuclear. I think we are all aware of the processes that have involved with nuclear program. We are all aware that nuclear remains an energy mix program, but you also know that regarding the implementation of a nuclear bill program, there were some legal issues that emerged, and there were some determinations that were made by the Constitutional Court. Our program unit is preparing a roadmap how to deal with nuclear. Whilst it forms part of energy mix, whilst there are issues that have been raised, whilst the court has raised serious issues around the nuclear program and its implementation and set aside the process, what's the next step? We have had a meeting, we have engaged with the program unit, and we will be informing the committee of that. As I've indicated, one won't be surprised if nuclear becomes part of IRP, as it remains the issue of the energy policy of the Department of Energy. However, it is equally important to take note of the issues that have been raised. You'll recall that the issue of the Constitutional Court mainly dealt with the how part, and that's the how part that we are busy dealing with. It did not deal with whether it's part of your energy policy or not. That was not a matter of the court. It dealt with the how part, it dealt with the Section 34 determination, how it has been done and so forth. So the matter is therefore legally challenged at the moment, but it's not about nuclear being part of the energy mix policy of the department. That is part. So it won't be surprising, as Honourable Davis has made the reflection to the fact that it's part of IRP. However, there are two parallel processes. It's IRP process and it's a legal process in the how we must implement. And on the how part, we all know, is the issue of the scale, is the issue of the financial modelling, is the issue of how it relates to other energy mix problems that we have, which IRP is meant to deal with as well. So those are two parallel processes running as well on the issue of nuclear. I hope I've covered the issues, Honourable Chair and Members, which I think they relate to DOE as the department in charge of various aspects of this presentation.
The issue of relocation of the office to SEF, are you in a position to answer that?
Honourable Chair, I was hoping you want to ask that question. I've whispered to my colleague Karen to say, is there any rationale that has been presented around the matter. I will ask that you allow me some space, Chair, to get into the logic of the matter. Surely it was a well-thought process which we need to look into. Again, it's a worrying factor which I think I do take cognizance of from the members, because at some point there was a proposal for IPP to handle some of the projects of this nature, and that was stopped. So if it has been reviewed, I think, Chair, I'll recommend that I'll be allowed to relook into the matter and come back to the committee and reflect on the correct internal arrangement on this matter.
Okay, thank you. Honourable members, I'm back to you. Honourable Yestazen, Honourable Davis, Honourable Matlana, in that order.
Chair, thank you. Yeah, it's a concern, Chair, that presenters admit that there was no planning for grid access made for renewable energy. Grid access can never be an afterthought. It's really an excess. And we spoke about cross-border projects as well. Grant Inga for one, which this department paid 150 million rand for, was dead born. Started in 2011 and it's dead born. There will nothing ever happen from Grant Inga. And how can it done? How is NERSA involved in feeding tariffs for the IPP program? And how in line is this with international tariffs? And I'm saying this because NERSA in the last 10, 11 years has increased approved electrical prices in this country 440%, and zero more capacity was ever created. And if I'm not mistaken, the price Eskom pays for IPP electricity will never increase more than inflation. This is fixed by contract. While Eskom's own electricity generation cost depends on Eskom's own management and efficiency, and this is really scary. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's it.
Thank you, Honourable Steve.
Thank you very much, Chair. Just some follow-ups. The first one is on, I'm just trying to find my place. Just on the signing of the outstanding projects. It seems to me like the presenter as well as the DG are saying that it's a diary constraint issue. Is that why these projects haven't been signed for? Because you just can't get people in the room. It just seems strange to me that's the key problem. Where is the urgency? Can't we just get everybody in a room to sign these agreements? If there's no more sticking points, if it's all been sorted, surely government can be a bit more efficient and just get the right people into the room, sign the agreements, and then we move forward from there. So I really don't understand what the delay is. What the DG said about the gazetting, he assumes, like I do, that it wasn't gazetted because there were concerns raised in the Cabinet, although we've had no communication on that. Could he tell us what concerns were raised in Cabinet over it? Because I think that's very important for Parliament to understand what concerns there were in the Cabinet at the time. Of course, we have a new Cabinet now, but it would be interesting to know what the old Cabinet thought about the IRP, and if there wasn't a unanimous agreement on the IRP in Cabinet. And if there are concerns, or if there were concerns, does it mean that a new Cabinet could rescind the old Cabinet's approval? Because obviously now there's a different balance of forces in the Cabinet. So what is his thoughts on that, and where are we with that? Then on the nuclear program, you say that you're preparing a roadmap to deal with nuclear, and that you won't be surprised if nuclear is part of the IRP as it's part of the DOE's energy policy. So are you saying that the nuclear deal is not off the table? Because the President at Davos said that we can't afford nuclear and we don't need it. I read that to mean that nuclear was off the table, but you seem to be saying that nuclear is back on the table. So can you please clarify for us? It's incredibly confusing to be on the receiving end of all of these mixed messages. So perhaps once and for all, you can tell us, is the nuclear deal on the table or is it off the table? Thank you.
Honorable Mandlala, thank you, Honorable Davis. Honorable Mandlala.
Sorry, Chair. Mine is it's not a follow-up question. I've asked this question, but I didn't get an answer from our beloved DG with regard to the issue of their relationship with ESCOM and SALGA. Maybe the reason why this project is not moving with the speed that we thought, it is because ESCOM is not reporting to the DOE. It's reporting to the public enterprises. Maybe they might be undermining the DOE because they don't account to them. So that's why I asked this relationship with ESCOM. I think they don't have an answer. Maybe the relationship is poor. That's why they can't answer this question. So maybe it might need a political decision by the principal, because this matter, it has been long overdue. Even the National Conference of the ANC failed to deal with the matter on taking ESCOM from public enterprise to the DOE so that it can be able to account correctly. Because the DOE is dealing with electricity. Public enterprise not dealing with electricity. So this thing must come to this ESCOM. There must be a political decision by the principal, because I think this matter is going to be with us for a long time. Even the new parliament, the sixth parliament, I think it won't be able to deal with this problem that we are seeing now with ESCOM. Simply ESCOM is undermining us. Maybe it might be proper for us to have a discussion, the DOE with the two ministers, the public enterprise, Pravin Gordhan, and our current minister here, to look into the integrities of this problem that the department is sitting on. This electricity thing is very serious. When I'm in my rural area, I'm from a rural area, all of us, I think. You sit there, watch Kaiser Chiefs and Orlando Pirates at 3 o'clock. Suddenly there is no electricity, the whole village. But when you go to Santon, there is nothing like that. Santon is number one in the whole country. And people start to toy, and some of us, they know that Matlala is serving in this department. Can we phone him? As if I'm working in ESCOM. I don't have answers to say yes. In 3 minutes time, you'll watch your Orlando Pirates and Kaiser Chiefs. So this matter is a very serious matter, Chair. The DG and the department cannot answer it. Let's have a discussion. The two committees must have a discussion on ESCOM. When is this ESCOM coming to the DOE? Because we are frustrated by them not accounting to us, yet they are dealing with electricity. This is a very serious matter. Maybe it might need us to say to our DG, to say, Marina Keno, take this message to your principal, to say we want the two committees and the two ministers, four of them in fact, to come and sit here and discuss this thing of ESCOM. It worries me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, you've got another follow-up?
I think it's because the honorable members support Kaiser Chiefs and not Pirates. That's why they phoned me.
Okay, thank you. Over to you, Mr. Tiche.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Honorable Davis, please, I've said it's my analysis and it's my assumptions, and the matter is on the agenda for discussion with the new minister. I'm referring to the RP. So I cannot put in this committee what are the concerns until that matter is discussed with the honorable minister, and the process of gazetting why it has not happened as yet is accordingly explained by the then acting DG for this committee. So I cannot therefore continuously make an analysis based on assumptions, and my assumptions are not even scientific for that matter, so those concerns cannot be even tabled here. So I cannot mislead Parliament and start doing that in this meeting. However, the IRP matter is on the agenda for engagement with our new minister. So that's the process. The signing matter as well, I think a lot has been said about changes that have occurred, and I don't think any honorable cabinet minister can just go and sign. A briefing process is critical. Understanding the issues at hand is also a very critical process, and that's precisely what we're doing, and I've indicated in my input that as of today, this afternoon, the very first briefing on the IPP program as a whole will take place with the Honorable New Minister. And that briefing, so it's not an issue of trying to get people in one room and just sign. It's a long process. I'm sure from the presentation you would have appreciated how comprehensive this program is, its dynamics, its policy dynamics, which again I think to a certain extent has contributed to different views regarding the financial modeling, particularly in relation to the financial modeling that is being applied, and that is the situation. On the nuclear, once again, Chair, I'm not sure about the nuclear deal, Chair. I've made my reference in relation to the legal process. There was a program that was started. There was a budget that was set aside preparing for the implementation of the nuclear. There was an intervention through a legal process, and the department is observing that legal process. So that's what we are doing. So I'm not going to be involved with announcements which are made at a political level. That's not my space, Honorable Chair, and I'll not get myself into it. It's a legal process. We are busy with the department. We are putting a roadmap how to deal with that, and at the right time, we'll come back to this committee and accordingly account as to how are we handling that process. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Dichi. I will give the last follow-up question to two gentlemen, or to one honorable, or two. Are you raising your hand? I noted the hand of Honorable Davis. I don't know. You would like me. You're not sure, Honorable Esteza, do you want to speak again? Honorable Davis, and the last one, if there is another person who wants to speak, if that will be the last one. Over to you, Honorable Davis.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks to the DG, and I respect what you've said today, and I understand the constraints that you are working under. But I just want to say that, Chair, maybe I can say it directed to you, that you know, this is what happens when the ministers don't come to the committee, because you get to a certain point in the conversation where the officials say, I can't answer that because it's a political decision, and I can't get into that. I can only give you my own personal assumption or my analysis, but I don't know what the minister's thinking, and I can't tell you what's happening in cabinet. So therefore, you know, we come here to learn what the political thinking is behind the decisions that are being taken by the department. So we actually come here to hold political principles to account. And when they don't come, first of all, it puts the officials in a very difficult position because they can't answer the questions. And it means that we walk away from this meeting none the wiser as to what's really going on in the heart of government, and that's really our job. So I would just like to register our objection to the absence of the ministers today, the minister and the deputy minister. You know, you can say what you like about Minister Mashlobo, and I think a lot of people have said a lot of things about him, but, you know, he used to come to this committee, and he used to engage with us, and he used to take us through the PowerPoint presentation, and he might have obfuscated and bumbled along, but he was here. And, you know, frankly, that's better than ministers who don't come and put the officials in a very, very difficult situation. So I'd just like to register our objection, hopefully the whole of the committee's objection, to the minister and the deputy minister's absence today.
Honorable Davis, I think I agree with you when it comes to the principle of ministers coming to the committee. However, let's give the new minister, Honorable Khadebe, a benefit of a doubt, a chance, because he apologized. We received his apology. It's not that he undermined the committee. He apologized that today he's busy with some cabinet commitments. And the teacher was also telling us that this afternoon they are meeting with the minister even the IPP office, they are meeting with the minister, the deputy minister, who frequently attends the community meetings, is sick. She also apologized. So on that note, I think, otherwise I agree with you that we need them, because now we put the officials under pressure. They have to answer things that are beyond their mandate and beyond policy issues. So I agree with you on that note. I think anyone wants to, or let me thank everybody. Thank you, DG, for your presence. Thank you, Mr. Ngobeni and Karim, Ms. Breitenberg. Thank you so much for the presentation. And thank people from NESA, ESCOM, other officials from the department, the chief director and the director, NGOs present here, the media. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for attending the meeting today. The meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.
When I come back, I'll check out.
Okay.
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 No, I want to come home. No, I want to come home.
No, no. All I'm going to do is I'm going to get my document, and I'll CC you in when I send it to you.
Okay.
So you can have an idea of what you've listened and what I've written. I tend to write a bit more than I should.
Yeah.
But that's what they want. But I think it's just a lot of.
Do they want rather more information than less, or do they want to have it like?
Talking about information.
Okay. Yeah.
Obviously irrelevant. Not irrelevant stuff. But sometimes it's what they talk about is totally useful.
Yeah. But I mean, the question about the nuclear would be very relevant.
But I have a question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I was wondering. If that was like technical. Yeah.
They're only here if they know there's no contradiction. Otherwise, you'll be upset. And they know that. So, I mean, you as you get more, you often, I know it's worth a show, but the business come here to try and talk to the we're going to put it into a recording, because this is often recorded in the public domain.
Yeah. And the lady just said the objection, is that like an official move, or is it just like a...
No, it's a committee view, but the committee has to agree to that.
Okay, so it didn't.
They didn't, so the way to see it, when it comes out in the... In this form of committee meeting, we normally get released the following week. It's only then that we will see. But I think because there was a chairperson there, and also there was a chairperson, the majority vote. Even if they vote in that, they probably won't agree to it because it's politically you don't agree with opposition.
Yeah.
That's also a tactic.
Yeah.
But I think he's got a very good point.
Yeah. Yeah.
If the chairperson was there and he said, yeah, I think it's a good point, let's agree to it, then there would have been agreement, right? But a good, I would record in my meeting that he suggested that the committee should object to it. But it's not, and then I'll say, but the committee did not vote on the issue. So
yeah.
That's sort of a mistake.
Okay, yeah.
But he made it, I mean, the point he raised, I mean, it's all good points. It's just, I mean, what seems to happen, I think most strong people are not here. So sometimes the views are raised,
But it's very interesting.
Yeah. No, no, that's why I come here even before I did this work, and then just come and look at it.
Yeah.
Okay, let me, a few, hopefully,